Welcome to Oh This World.
This is a podcast for people inclined to take action in the age of coronavirus. As Americans and as Texans, we wonder about the choices we are personally making in this new world disorder.
And because our state and federal governments have failed to provide the leadership necessary to help all of us make informed decisions, it sometimes seems like we're all on our own.
But at a time when it's easy to feel helpless, we're focused on action. I'm Antoinette Perez.
And I'm Lucas Schaefer. We're friends, engaged citizens, and progressive activists in Austin, Texas.
Our mission is to help Texans and people across the country hold our leaders accountable and build an America that leaves no one behind.
So wash your hands, grab a drink, and join us for Oh This World. Hello and welcome to Oh This World. I'm Lucas Schaefer. Today we are going to be talking about why there isn't collective mourning in the face of COVID-19, who that benefits, who that hurts, and what we can do about it. Antoinette, hello.
Hello, Lucas.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty mellow today, feeling good overall. And you?
You know, it's a rainy day here in Austin. It's Memorial Day, which typically, of course, is used to honor those who have died in war. But it did feel, especially as we get towards 100,000 American deaths, like this topic of mourning and grieving and why we are not doing it as a nation was appropriate for this weekend. So a happy topic, as usual, on this light, feel-good show. Before we do that, we do have a few follow-ups. So on Friday, Antoinette, we had mentioned that you had a couple of appointments. You had a dentist appointment and a hair appointment, right?
And on Instagram, a listener called me out on it too. Just said, I'm really surprised by this.
Well, this is like Planet Fitness. We're a judgment-free zone. We're a no-judgment zone. But I did want to just call everyone's attention to an NPR story that came out on May 23rd. From camping to dining out, here's how experts rate the risks of 14 summer activities. And I just found this useful. Basically, they consulted these NPR reporters, and we'll post this up, of course, asked a panel of infectious disease and health experts to risk the activities for the summer, obviously with the caveat that, you know, your personal risks depend on multiple factors that they can't, obviously, you know.
They can't guarantee.
Of course not. And they quote Dr. Emily Landon, a hospital epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist, with this kind of shorthand rule of thumb, always choose outdoors over indoor, always choose masking over not masking, and always choose more space for fewer people over a smaller space. So did you have a chance to take a look at this great list?
Yes, I did.
How did you feel? What did you think?
I felt fine. I didn't feel particularly called out, even though I believe the hairdresser was a medium to high risk activity. Because the whole point of it is that it comes down to agreements that you reach beforehand about how you'll behave with the people that you are congregating with, and trust in protocol and behavior and following those agreements that were made beforehand. So I feel totally fine. And it's not like I'm going, you know, every week or something.
No, of course. I did see on Twitter Mayor Adler, and I loved this, posted some video of crowded spots downtown and actually called out a few places by name.
Ooh.
And which I thought was great, because I said this earlier on Twitter, and I feel strongly about it, that, you know, everyone is free to do whatever they want within the law, but we are also free within the law to hold people accountable for doing whatever they want.
Mm.
And, you know, seeing some of these images this weekend, it definitely made me feel like the responsible thing to do is to shelter in place as much as possible. And, you know, one thing I thought was helpful about this list was, you know, it wasn't really saying, do it, don't do it. It was saying, here's the risk across these different things. The one thing I would just encourage everyone to remember, obviously, and obviously you, this is not, I'm not calling out Antoinette here. I was pro the, you know, it was a deliberate act that you took with a lot of forethought, but, you know, just remembering that whatever you're doing is also putting others at risk, because we don't know, you know, if you're asymptomatic, you also would not know that. So just, we'll post up the list. It has 14 different activities. Basically, you know, go camping, take your kids outside on hikes as long as they're away from other people, and kind of continue to hunker down as best you can.
As best we can. And we're lucky that we both can.
And we're lucky we both can. Exactly. Okay. You also had a bit of a follow-up or an interesting piece that came out, I believe, in the New York Times last week. Tell us about that.
Yes. This was an article about Americans eroding faith in government. Mm. And in some ways, it is an underpinning of this entire podcast. I don't think that you and I would be doing this podcast if we felt like our government's leadership was strong and effective.
Right.
So this idea of public trust is always an undercurrent, I think, in every single podcast episode that we do. And I appreciated, you know, a couple of the interviews that they did with a variety of different folks who they, you know, went ahead and named their political affiliation, but generally got quotes from them about their past experience, life experience, why they started to feel less trust in government, and what they would like to see moving forward. A couple of quotes in there that I think are interesting and worth commenting on.
Sure.
There's a gentleman in there who, he's like 42, he's a veteran, and he says, there was this well of goodwill and intention to help, and that's been squandered. When people feel their goodwill has been squandered, that's when they lose faith in government, which is exactly what you've been saying in the past couple of weeks, Lucas, about how we all sheltered in place with confidence that our leaders were going to take that time that we were giving them to find solutions.
Right.
And they didn't. And all we got was, okay, the economy needs to open again. Our business leaders need to make money again. So everybody come back out and play. That's not the same thing. There's also a woman in the article who's, I think, in her 70s now. Mm. And she says, we still don't really have health care. We're still paying high prices for drugs. We are still in a war that has lasted for 17 years. And they identified her, and she self-identified as a Democrat. Me voting for Joe Biden isn't going to change any of that. That's what's frustrating. I don't think that she was trying to say she wasn't going to vote. I think that she was just making a statement of her belief that putting someone new in the White House isn't necessarily going to change the everyday quality of life that she's experiencing.
I would just say, I mean, fine, that's an interesting opinion, I guess. But I would just say, tell it to the 100,000 dead Americans who wouldn't be dead if there was different leadership in the White House. I mean, I agree. We can agree giant structural change is needed. You know, is Joe Biden this avatar of change? Is that the first thing you think of? Maybe not. But it is depressing to me to think, well, we now know that literally thousands of Americans are dead because of unpreparedness on the part of the government. So the fact that people are still saying it doesn't matter who's in charge, I do find irritating. I would also just say that it's also deliberate on the part of Republicans who don't believe in having a federal government essentially to do anything except to subsidize them. So they've been saying they hate government and they're not good at running it. And, you know, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think that not only does the statement to me reveal that she probably hasn't been personally touched by this pandemic. I also think that in general, she's not touched necessarily by the worst legislation that we've seen in the last 3.5 years from this current administration. So,
right,
speaking a little bit from a seat of privilege, And right. And what I like about what she's saying, and I think works in it to kind of reinforce what you and I keep talking about, is that this is great if we can replace this clown in the White House. That's great. Where the real work needs to happen is what we are doing on an everyday basis to engage and to push for change. And I don't really get the sense that this person is someone who shows up and engages in the way that we are asking people to do on a regular basis.
Sure.
And where that ends in the story is that trust of the federal government is very different from trust in local government. And the story says that in 2018, about 2/3 of Americans said they viewed their local government favorably, according to Pew, as opposed to, I think it was like 17%, the story said, have faith in federal government. So 2/3 of Americans said local government's good. And there's some evidence that during this crisis, people are learning to rely on one another in their communities and rediscovering the power of local government. So there is a lining here. And yes, change at the White House is great. Change all the way at every level is really what we need to push for.
I do not disagree. I do not disagree. I will be pushing back every time we hear anyone say, oh, they're the same, da 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 da. I can't handle it. I cannot handle it. But I understand there's more to it than that. Okay. So today we are talking about, this is such a bummer, this episode. I mean, I think we have really pretty good information to talk about, and it's important to talk about. But I'm just like, I mean, obviously 100,000 dead Americans is like unfathomable and terrible and all of the things, but I cannot get over how A, unnecessary many of these deaths were, and then the just callousness of the president and Republican leaders in dealing with this catastrophe. I'm not one of those people who is going to say, oh my God, I'm so surprised that Donald Trump, who everything he has touched in his entire life, he has ruined for his entire life, has done this. I'm not going to say I'm so surprised. He was a disaster before being president, and it, you know, this is what you get. But it's just a bummer that we have to have a conversation about why are we not honoring and being respectful of Americans or of anyone who has died. It's just ridiculous. So I just wanted to get that out there, that I'm personally just feel blech about the fact that we even have to have this conversation, but I do think it's an important conversation to have.
Definitely important. And I'm glad we're having it. I feel particularly mellow and reflective today, so it's just in time.
Well, that is, yes, this is going to be mellow, but reflective, but also somewhat action oriented. So, okay. Did you see the New York Times cover on Sunday? Because I feel like we have said a few times, like, why are it? It felt like the dead were not the main story. And on Sunday, the New York Times ran a full page, a full cover of 1,000 names of people who had died. So 1% of the Americans who had died, with not only that, not only their names and their ages and where they were from, but also they scoured obituaries from local papers across the country. And there's a little article we'll post, the project behind a front page full of names on sort of how they put this together. And they had a little sort of sentence about each of these 1,000 names. I thought it was very powerful to see. And then the craziest part about this for me personally is at the very beginning of this, my great uncle got COVID and died on March 25th. And he was one of the names on the on the list. So this morning, I actually had looked yesterday. I thought, well, there's not a very high chance of it being 1%. And I didn't see it. And then my dad emailed me this morning. And sure enough, radiologist, woodworker, artist, and scholar, Robert Earl Schaefer, 87, in Seattle. So wow. I have to say, you know, this was not someone I knew especially well. I'd certainly, obviously, met him and was sad that he passed away, and sad for my family. It wasn't a someone I knew especially closely, but it was still very, you know, when you see the name and you see the description, I don't know. It was striking. It was nice to see him honored in that way. So I thought that was a very cool thing. Also, this, we're going to come back to this, but this little preamble I did where I said, oh, da-da-da-da-da, didn't know that well, da-da-da-da-da, I want to come back to that because this is actually, this relates to my call to action. I just did something that I have been trying not to do. So we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
So what we're going to talk about today is why we aren't having collective mourning. I think it's fair to say we're not. Who that benefits, who it hurts. It hurts most of us. It benefits very few people. And then what we can do about it. So I just wanted to give a little context before we get into it. NPR headline from May 22nd, President Trump orders flags to fly at half staff as the U.S. mourns nearly 100,000 dead. And then my favorite sentence from this piece, the decision comes after Democratic leaders in Congress sent a letter to the president requesting the gesture. Antoinette, why did this? Why are we putting the flags down now as opposed to 2 months ago? And why are they going back up? So they're doing it through the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And then Monday, obviously, today, the flags go down for fallen soldiers, which also seems, I mean, just the fact that, the whole thing drives me completely insane. But what is your take on why this has taken so long?
Really quick, they're just in avoidance mode. They don't want to talk about it, think about it, deal with it. They don't want to talk about reality. They want to keep deflecting and creating their own sense of priority and mission. And what's the saying now? Transition into greatness? Some crap like that.
Who says that?
I mean, our president.
Oh, Jesus.
I think that's his new tagline, his new rally cry in the age of COVID. Yeah, I mean, the less that they talk about it, the less chance there will be for them to be called on publicly to be accountable for it.
It really is. It is shocking to me. It is shocking to me and quite sick that the Republican Party essentially completely screwed this up. There's no reason 100,000 Americans should be dead. They failed to prepare. They failed on testing. They failed in all of the ways we've talked about on other shows. And now, instead of taking responsibility, instead of saying the buck stops here, we're just supposed to pretend that this essentially didn't happen, or that it happens all the time. People get sick all the time. And we're going to talk after the break about some of the talking points Republicans are using, but you know,
it's not going to happen. They're not going to have the buck stops here moment. They're not going to take responsibility for this, and they're not going to have any of these conversations that are real and necessary, which is part of the reason why you and I are doing this podcast, is that every episode we're having real and necessary conversations and grappling with realities and refusing to look away.
It's just, it's wild to me that, you know, the lack of respect for human life from the Republican Party is profound. And, you know, I keep seeing this thing of, oh, after Benghazi, when, you know, four Americans died, the Republicans had months of these sort of show trial congressional hearing nonsense that weren't really about getting to the bottom of anything. They were just about, you know, lambasting Hillary Clinton. And, you know, after 9/11, obviously, when thousands of Americans died, we not only mourned collectively, but, you know, went to war again with the wrong country. They don't care about human life. Benghazi was not about the four people who were lost. Benghazi was, honestly, the Republicans were clinking their champagne glasses when Benghazi happened because it was a cudgel to use. It was not, I almost can't articulate. I feel like we've had a few episodes where my frothing rage has been like more at like a comfortable like jacuzzi bubbling. This one, it's just, I mean, it is completely infuriating. So when we get back, we're going to talk about sort of the ways that Republicans have undermined any form of national mourning and have undermined just the reality that 100,000 Americans have died. We're going to talk about why they think that helps them, how it hurts the rest of us, and what we can do about it. Okay, we are back. Where to begin? Antoinette, I want to start with a tweet that a tweet from Jamel Bowie, the New York Times columnist, that he had a couple days ago that I thought was really interesting and correct. He said, "I've been thinking a lot about what it means that we are not collectively mourning the losses from COVID-19 and how the absence of public mourning isn't just crass, but also something which undermines any kind of solidarity among the community of the living." And I think this ties in so perfectly with all of our talking about why aren't we coming together as a nation to make masks, to, you know, employ people who are unemployed? Why is there not this big national New Deal style effort to do anything? All we hear from the Republicans is we can't do it. We can't do it. We can't do it. Which also is not a politically winning message that, you know, America can't do it. America isn't up to the task. That's what I'm hearing from Republicans essentially. But I think it's tied in with this mourning thing, because if we all acknowledge that 100,000 people are dead, and if we all acknowledge they don't need to be dead, certainly not all of them, and if we all acknowledge there's something we can do about it and there are things we can be doing, it goes against all of the Republican beliefs, which are, number one, holding on to power no matter what the cost. And clearly they believe that acknowledging these deaths makes them culpable in some way, which they are. and also they don't believe in the power of the federal government to do anything except to pay their salaries. I mean, that's what they like the federal government for, and otherwise it's just something to vilify.
I think some of them just don't know how.
And some of them are not competent, right?
No.
To do this. Do you feel it? Do you feel the froth?
I'm still in mellow zone right now, but I did feel froth earlier today on a completely different note, reading through the president's tweets this weekend. All of the things he was tweeting about and not this, that kind of got me in a bit of a froth.
Okay, this is a good, we are getting better at our segues, Antoinette. It's not as if Republicans are going out and saying, and when I say Republicans, I'm talking about our elected Republican leaders. I'm not talking about just...
We're not talking about the ones that refuse to say anything about them. We're just talking about the ones that are actually
correct.
Engaging yes. in the most egregious right. behavior.
Those people are not off the hook either.
They are not.
They're not, but that's not who I'm talking about right now. So it's not like they're coming in and saying 100,000 people aren't dead. They just have this never-ending list of excuses as to why we shouldn't care, why they don't care, why it doesn't count. So I just wanted to go over just a couple of those. Another tweet that I thought was good this weekend that I saw was from Matt Zoller Seitz, the writer, who said, "I'm angriest about this widespread talking point among Republicans that it doesn't matter when older people die from COVID because they were old. How the hell could you possibly know when their time was? They could have lived another 5, 10, 20 years for all you know." So I keep seeing, and I am going to call out Chip Roy because his behavior during this has been abysmal, embarrassing, gross, amoral, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, his whole thing is, oh, they're all in nursing homes. They're all in nursing homes. They're all so old. He had something the other day, more people over 100 in Minnesota died than under 50. So there. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. So first of all, we know that coronavirus affects people of all ages, right? We know that. Okay. So that's one thing. But second of all, I just find this so perverse and weird that we're saying, oh, well, they're old. I mean, if you look at the list of people who have died, first of all, the range of ages, I mean, what is old enough for Chip Roy to be sacrificed so that his portfolio does well for a couple days? Is it 60? Is it 70? Is it 80? Is it 90? I mean, I don't know. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, my grandfather died when he was 97. Now, I'd say around 96, he was not fully there. 95, pretty there. Pretty there. I mean, if he died when he was 80, that would have basically been my entire, the entire adult portion of my life knowing him would have not existed.
Yeah.
So it's just, I guess I don't know what their point is. In addition to it just not being true that younger people and middle-aged people aren't affected and don't die by this, in addition to that not being true, I guess I don't see what their point is. I mean, are we, you know, 65, you're no longer working, so if you die, that somehow doesn't count? I mean, it's just callous and gross, and I'm sick of it.
He's not the first one, though. Remember Dan Patrick's comments early in COVID said, yeah, everybody above 65 would rather die than watch their grandkids suffer through a poor economy.
I mean, I will give Chip this. He doesn't wear a mask anywhere, and he goes wherever he pleases. So I guess he's at least living up to the courage of his convictions and is perfectly happy to get sick and get other people sick. Although he's not, I guess he's not old, really. I don't know. It just, it's such a gross, weird talking point, especially from the ostensibly pro-life party. I guess there's nothing else to say about it other than, you know, I mean, it's just a bad argument. It's a bad argument. there's nothing more to really say. The other thing I did want to point people, because the other thing we keep hearing, Chip Roy loves this, is the lockdown is going to end up killing more people than the sickness itself. So there's no real data to back this up. This is
he's just psychic all of a sudden.
Well, it's, you know, Chip follows his gut, and as we all know, for the last 18 months he's been shoveling down Chick-fil-A to prove how heterosexual he is. So that's what's in the gut. That's what's in his gut. I don't know why he's expecting to find something other than fried chicken in his gut, because that's what he's been eating for 18 months. Not to go down that road, but another thing they keep saying is this, and I just wanted to point out an article that we will post by Matthew Zeitlin. I saw it on Medium. I'm not sure. Unfortunately, I'm not sure where it's from. But what Americans need to know to understand about the Swedish coronavirus experiment. So basically, Republicans keep pointing to Sweden and saying, well, they didn't lock down, and it's not the end of the world for Sweden, so, like, why aren't we doing that? And I would just encourage everyone to go read this read this piece because it makes a number of interesting points. Among them, just to be real quick here, the economy is still projected to contract in Sweden by 7%. Unemployment will rise to just over 10%. They've still had thousands of deaths. So it's not exactly like just by those metrics, this is such a great idea. But this writer made some other really interesting points, which I hadn't thought of or heard. Among them, this is a quote, "Multiple experts in Sweden I spoke to agreed that because a recommendation made by Swedish leadership is culturally viewed as more of a demand, the freedoms allowed have not resulted in free-for-alls." I mean, unfortunately, that is not American culture, where everything is a culture war, and if you know, Democrats say it can't be true, and if the authority says it can't be true, and we're conspiracy theorists and all of that. So for starters, there's social trust in Sweden that doesn't exist here, right?
Yeah.
The other thing, you can probably hear me flipping, I'm flipping pages like a maniac. The article ends this way. Again, this is Matthew Zeitlin writing about Sweden. "Meanwhile, the American push to reopen is being driven by distrust of the government combined with the absence of robust safety net programs to stem the economic bleeding. In the American context, Sweden's example may be no example at all." So, you know, again, Republicans have been arguing, let's get rid of protections for pre-existing conditions, let's have there be no social safety net, and then let's all open. And if people get sick, well, most of them will be over 65 anyway, and those people are not contributing to the economy in their minds, right? In the minds of Republicans, so who cares? Whew. Okay. So that's where we are. In terms of who this helps, I guess it Republicans see it as helping them in the short term. I think that is, I mean, do you think that will actually work, Antoinette?
For their diehard followers, sure.
Yeah.
For the rest of us, no.
For the rest of us, no. And it just isn't right. It doesn't feel right. You know, there's no National Day of Mourning. There's nothing. There's nothing. There's the president is golfing. Okay, so we know that they think it helps them a little bit. How does it hurt the rest of us? So on the one hand, we have this patriotism issue, which I really think is a serious problem, right? Mm-hmm. That when we get rid of any sense of we're all in this together, then there can't be a solution that all of us can contribute to. Right. So that's the first thing. And then the other thing is there's a Washington Post story saying goodbye, unable to gather in grief. We must find new ways to mourn by Sonny Fitzgerald that came out April 24th. That, and we're going to talk about this in a minute. I thought it had a lot of great ideas for individual ways to mourn a loved one during this time. She was talking about the individual. This writer wasn't really talking about the collective as much. But, you know, one thing Sonny Fitzgerald pointed out was that, you know, grief takes sort of a physical and mental toll on the grievers, right? Sort of whether they're acknowledging that or feeling that at the time or not. And I do feel like collectively, I don't know. Are people out of sorts, even ones who have not experienced a death from coronavirus?
Yeah, sure. Earlier in the lockdown period, there were some pieces circulating out there around how the feeling that many of us couldn't name was loss and grief over loss, loss of expectations, loss of lifestyle, loss of freedoms, loss of all of those things. And that, sure, we were going into shelter in place with all the best intentions to help everybody out, and that there were things that we were grieving and that many of us had not thought of it in that context. So yeah, I think in addition to real people, grieving real people, many of us have been feeling some level of grief over transitioning so quickly into this new way of being.
A level of grief without processing it in right. any way as a country, right?
That's right.
This one is a bummer. Sorry, everybody. We have there's things we can do, but
I don't think it's always a bummer though to talk about things that haven't been talked about. And no. And again, engaging in these necessary conversations, nobody wants to have them, and sometimes without them, the finding healing just takes a lot longer.
Well, and I also think the reason I said at the beginning I wanted to talk about this again. I mean, I think the reason some leadership is required here is because, like, I've noticed, like, okay, so like my great uncle died, right, Uncle Bob, mm-hmm. and partially because, like, you know, people's like parents have died, their children have died, they're really immediate people, you know, they knew intimately have died. When this has come up, I have always kind of had a preamble of, you know, this was an older relative who I did not know as well as many relatives. And in part, that is just some perspective, because you don't want to be, you know, I don't know, making something about you that's not about you. But I also just think that's a normal human thing to do, because it's sort of easier when dealing with death to say, oh, well, they had a pre-existing condition. They were really old. They, right. you know. But I think it kind of is not. I really want to try to stop doing that, because I feel like it does make it about you as opposed to about the person who died, right? Mm. I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's a huge deal, but I've just been.
Do you mean conscious. That, like, we say those things sometimes to give ourselves comfort, and in doing so, that it's more about us than about the person who died?
Yeah, and also I think it's just. I think it's hard for people to just say, oh, this happened. It's really sad. It sucks. This is who this person was, you know. That's what I liked about the New York Times cover. It was mm-hmm. like, you know, I don't know. I think we're not great with just sitting with unpleasantness and sitting with grief. So at least I'm just talking about me personally, and not just in this case, but in
well,
life.
I don't know if you were planning to bring up the other New York Times piece that you had linked to and I read.
Let's talk about
beautiful.
That.
It was Ooh. So beautiful. And it touches on all these things that you're talking about here, that it's kind of a bummer to talk about these things, and yet the bummer is the reality. So one of the quotes that I pulled from it said...
You're talking about Teju Cole's...
That's the one, yeah.
So this is a novelist and writer who has a piece about... He starts to keep a diary
for 1 week. He gives you the entries for 1 week. Right. And it's beautiful end to end. I just loved reading yes. it. But the first quote that jumped out at me that is completely relevant to what you just said, the front pages here seem to often carry news of the financial markets or of the political squabbles of the day. But what I want is to be directly confronted with the fact, the enormity, the irreducible sadness of all these deaths.
Yes.
I mean, yes. Isn't this why a week ago you and I talked about every episode doing a count?
Yeah.
I mean, just doing an accounting of life, loss of yes. life, right?
Yes. And I think what I was just trying to say, I just feel like there's so much throat clearing and preamble giving and making exceptions. And, you know, at some point we just need to confront 100,000 people who were here aren't here.
Yes.
Anymore. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of them could be here. that's why we're really not talking about this, because if we start to acknowledge reality, mm-hmm. we then dig into why that reality exists. I agree, though. That was a really great essay.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. He also talked about the question that you just asked, you know, are we feeling this thing collectively? And he has a theory as to why we don't here in the U.S.
And what is that theory?
There's no collective is the exact phrase. In the United States, there is no collective.
Yes.
Levity in the midst of sorrow can be a consolation if the sorrow is shared to begin with. But here, where everything is divided, where the unscathed can't quite believe the wounded, the levity sounds like anything but solidarity. COVID-19 mm-hmm. was initially heralded as a great equalizer, and there was some evidence of this in some countries, maybe aka Sweden. He doesn't say that. That's my edit. But it arrived in America and immediately became American, classist, capitalist, complacent. We feel seen.
Sounds about right. Sounds about right. Yeah. And there's also been no, I agree there's no collective, but there's also been zero attempts to acknowledge this or account for it in any way on the part of our leadership. Okay, so we're, for our call to action, we're going to talk, you know, a little bit about things we can do to correct this collective problem. I did find, did you read, Antoinette, the Washington Post sort of that Sonny Fitzgerald piece about...
I did.
So this had sort of all different ways that people could just grieve at an individual level from, you know, sort of Zoom gatherings to... There were some... there were some less obvious things than that. I thought, what did you make of this piece?
I thought it was lovely. There were some things that I had been thinking about, planting a tree in honor of someone, and she kind of included that in her list. I thought about doing art and having people contribute pieces that could be collected together and displayed together at some point when we are all, you know, safe to be around each other. And then there were some that I was kind of like, okay, that's unusual, but that might work in certain cases. Who am I to judge? It was great. It was really nicely written.
Yeah, it was nicely written. Does your family have any sort of grief or mourning traditions like that?
My dad, who is deeply, deeply Catholic, his family has the whole 10 days of rosaries at midnight after a loved one has died.
Right.
Very, very intense, very deeply religious and ritualistic. And there are other things. I mean, you know, very public displays of mourning at funerals and things like that.
Yeah. So we'll post up that piece, and it may give you some ideas. It may just be, I just found it, I find it nice when people are just actually talking about this.
Yes.
As opposed to whatever nonsense, you know, we're usually talking about in the news. Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back with a call or two to action. Okay, Antoinette.
Lucas.
What can we do about this? So we kind of have an individual call to action, and then we have a way we can collectively act that perhaps is a little more something that we've said before.
I find this really funny because I had written a couple things down that you and I didn't talk about, and I don't know if I should put those out there.
I think you should. Okay. Why don't we start there? Let's start there.
One of the things is, and I, what inspired this was that Teju Cole piece that we just talked about, where he says, you know, the newspapers in other areas always include like a current death count on the front page and they don't hear. And I thought to myself, if that's not the way that we're doing things, then maybe a letter to the editor sharing a story about a loved one, sharing a story about, and I mean, you only have 150 words or whatever, so it can't be a long story, but tying some piece that the newspaper has written about death count back to someone that you know, and that your act of writing this letter on their behalf is sort of your way of honoring them.
Yeah, well, and that goes right in with the broader call to action, right, of finding ways to humanize this crisis, both for yourself and publicly. So whether that is, I think it's just easy, especially, you know, we're not in New York City. We're not in a hot spot yet.
Right.
So it's kind of easy within the confines of sort of sheltering in place and all of the other weird stuff that is happening, to not to forget about it, but to have some distance from it. So, you know, I was thinking just for myself that I really do want to make an effort to, and obviously I'm following this stuff pretty closely just through our podcast and through our lives, but really trying to kind of, you know, God, I wrote this down and now saying it, it seems so like morbid and odd. I said, read an obituary a day. That is an odd call to action. But what I do mean by that is just, you know, forcing yourself to put a human face on this a little bit more if you feel distant from it. I'm not going to put on our call to action, you must read one obituary a day. But, you know, I mean, ooh, that's some dark, strange humor. But you know what I'm saying, Antoinette? Just finding ways.
Yes.
Just to personally humanize this. There were some in that article, kind of some rituals that were suggested, like lighting a candle, saying a prayer, you know, just acknowledging what our leadership has failed to acknowledge. And then I think the second half of that, right, is exactly what you were saying. So sharing those human stories through letters to the editor, through, you know, that's actually a great way
to social media.
Through social media. Social media. Yes.
Early on, there were some stories that I saw of some of the first US COVID deaths on Twitter, and they were devastating. They were devastating.
It was interesting. Yesterday, I was noticing a lot of people on social media were retweeting the New York Times cover, and they'd picked out sort of a person who I don't think they knew personally, but the biography was meaningful to them in some way, and they were just retweeting out the name and what was written about that person. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, God, compared to all of the crap I see on social media every day, this I actually find useful.
Worthwhile.
And worthwhile, yeah, mm-hmm. to actually learn about. I mean, that's what I'm saying when I'm saying read obituaries. I mean, you know, actually honor these mm-hmm. people who have died. You know, actually do it. And then, okay, our final call to action, this is, you know, everyone's going to roll their eyes when I say this. It's fine. We know that repetition in politics is important, which is maybe why I repeat myself all the time. But we need to replace our leadership and replace them with people who will not make us have this episode again.
It's unacceptable. The behavior is unacceptable, and we need to let them know.
And it's just wrong. I mean, there is such a thing in this world as right and wrong. As much as the Republicans have now become the party of moral relativism, and who's to say what the truth is, and who's to say, no, there is truth, there is right and wrong, this behavior is wrong, we can do better. So all of those normal things of, if you're not involved with that campaign in your district, now's the time to get involved. As Antoinette said at the beginning, it is not just replacing Donald Trump. This needs to be at every level of government, because the Republican Party at every level is behaving badly.
And because we deserve better.
Well, we deserve better if we fight to get
fight for
better.
It. Yep.
Right.
I got you.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to report on Wednesday we're moving to a much more hilarious topic, gaslighting. Oh my goodness. This is...
We've really opened up some sort of a box here with this podcast. I had no idea when we started that we'd be talking about mourning and gaslighting in the same week. And those are our two showcase topics.
Well, you know, it's literally the least we can do to be acknowledging that we need to do better. Okay.
It's a sign of the times, that's for sure.
Indeed. All right, friends, you can find us at Oh This World Pod on Twitter and Instagram, on email at ohthisworldpod@gmail.com. We are on all of the channels, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast. Share a pod with your friends. Wherever you listen, please subscribe and rate us. We have a Patreon now. You can find that.
Patreon.com/OhThisWorldPod.
Thank you.
Lucas, you have done such a great job. Thank you for digging in and taking us through this morning topic.
All right. Well, have a good rest of your day, Antoinette. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you Wednesday.
Bye.